In a moment, the All-American Sports Show, but first, from NBC News. Allied and Communist liaison officers went into a surprise session an hour ago at Panmunjom at the request of the Communists. We've just learned that the Allies have granted a Communist request for an additional day's recess in the full-scale Korean talks. The top negotiators had been scheduled to meet at 1 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time, but this has been postponed for one day. NBC had been ready to remain on the air until 2 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time to bring you direct reports from the truce tent, but this schedule has been canceled. However, NBC will continue to bring you the latest news. Now, the All-American Sports Show on NBC.
The All-American Sports Show. The National Broadcasting Company presents the second in a series of new dramatic shows, The All-American Sports Show, dedicated to those figures in the world of sports and to their fans who, by their example, have upheld in American sports the traditions of courage and bravery, sportsmanship and honor. To tell us tonight's story, here's a fellow who is both a sports reporter and a sports fan, Joe Hassel.
Yes, I've been a sports reporter for some time now. As a reporter, I try to look at sports objectively, without letting my personal feelings carry me away. But every now and then, someone comes along who shows us what it means to be a champion, that it means more than quickness and skill, more than speed and strength. There are champions in all walks of life. But because I'm a sports reporter and a sports fan, I'm glad we have our share. I can't tell you just what makes a champion, but I can tell you why Ben Hogan is one of the best. It was early on a February morning in 1949. It was a foggy, misty morning as a big, powerful car purred along a Texas highway. The car seemed cozy and warm to the man and his wife spinning through the mist. They rode along in quiet contentment, for they were going home. Two headlights loomed out of the fog, the blurred outline of a truck approaching. Then suddenly there were four glaring lights bearing down, blocking the road. A huge bus was trying to pass the onrushing truck. The brakes screamed. The big car swerved. There was a sickening crash. And then silence. The powerful car was a crumpled mass of twisted wreckage. The tires were ripped from the wheels. The steering wheel was driven through the seat. And inside the smashed car was a slender, crushed figure. The body of a man who had instinctively thrown himself in front of his wife at the last split second to protect her. Then, for an hour and a half on that lonely roadside, the figure of a woman crouched by the form of her husband in the gloomy fog. Shocked and dazed, but unharmed, she waited for the welcome sound of an ambulance siren. She watched them roll the broken form on a stretcher, then watched beside him as the ambulance pulled away. Leaving only the police at the scene that marks the beginning of a legend.
What a tough break, especially for a guy like Ben Hogan.
Yeah. Well, we better get things cleaned up here. Say, what's this? A busted golf club.
Sure, they're scattered all over the place.
Well, they won't be needing these anymore.
That should be the ending of the story. But let's go back to the beginning. When you think of Texas, you think of wide open spaces and big, strapping six-footers. Maybe that helped to make it tough for a skinny, undersized kid down in Fort Worth. When it came to picking up sides for games, it went something like this.
I'll take Murphy.
Harrison.
Williams.
Well, let's see. Who's left? Nobody but Hogan, huh? Okay, I'll take Ben.
But Ben didn't have much time for games anyway. He was too busy selling papers to help his mother, who had become a widow when he was 9 years old. But then he heard that you could make some money being a caddy out at the Glen Garden Country Club. He hung around, but the kids there ran you off the job unless you could fight your way in. Little Ben wasn't looking for trouble, but he didn't run away, and he got the job. As he toted the heavy bags of clubs through long hours under the blazing sun, he saw that this was a game that he could play. A game where you could show the big guys up if you had what it takes. He caddied for the tips he had to earn, but he watched and he learned. Even when he was dead tired, he practiced every moment that he could. When night was falling on the deserted course, you might have smiled to see this skinny kid still swinging away, his eyes squinted and his mouth set tight in determination. Because he took himself so seriously, the other guys kidded him when he made a mistake.
Oh, boy, look at that drive.
It must have gone all of 20 yards.
I bet Bobby Jones is worried.
But when he was 14 years old, he won the caddy championship. He didn't show how he felt about it, but you can imagine how proud he was. This little guy who made the others look up to him for a change. And you can imagine the dreams that whirled through his mind.
Please, Mr. Hogan, could I have your autograph? I have Red Grange, Jack Dempsey, Babe Ruth. Could I have your autograph?
I'm from United Associated Press, Mr. Hogan. May I ask some questions after they take your picture for the newsreels?
I'm Vanderbilt Morgan, the banker, Mr. Hogan. And I want you to meet my beautiful daughter. She's just crazy about you.
Well, as he grew up, he was a pretty fair country golfer for a little fellow. He kept on working and playing at the country club. He saw the confident, successful men and the young fellows who drove their own cars and took the prettiest girls to the club dances. They admired him for his skill, but he wasn't one of them. No, he wasn't born to the country club set, so he clamped his jaw harder and practiced more. When he was 20 years old, the age when the country club kids were going to college, he took his golf clubs and the few dollars he had saved and set off for Los Angeles to tackle the tournaments. Even the entrance fees were a problem, and he had to live as cheaply as he could. When lunchtime came, the big shots ate in the clubhouse dining room or at the homes of wealthy members while he gulped down a sandwich and a glass of milk. No one paid any attention to him, and the few worn dollars kept trickling away. The kindest words he heard were something like this.
You better pick up and beat it, kid. You hit a nice long ball, but you don't belong up here.
You're a long way from Fort Worth, kid, and you've got a long way to go.
Why don't you forget it, kid? A little guy has two strikes on him to start with.
So he took his golf clubs and a broken dream back to Fort Worth. It was depression time, and things were tough all over. He took odd jobs to keep himself going while he practiced more and more. Even when he worked with the rough and ready gangs in the Texas oil fields, he took what time he could to smack a golf ball against a wall of concrete sacks.
I do declare, Harold, I forgot to wear my plus fours.
I wonder if I could borrow your gloves. My hands blister so easily.
All right, but be careful, and don't forget to yell four.
He got a job as pro at the Oakhurst Country Club. Country clubs were having hard times, too, and the future was uncertain. But in 1935, in the middle of the Depression, he married Valerie Fox, a girl he'd gone to school with in Fort Worth. There were some decisions to be made then. Some difficult decisions.
Why don't you just get a steady job and settle down?
You can still play golf in your spare time.
You're no world beater.
You ought to know that by now.
Just look where you are.
You're not getting any place.
Now that you're married, you shouldn't take chances with the future.
That's right. Get a steady job and settle down.
But golf had become a part of Ben Hogan's life. And all his wife, Valerie, demanded was that Ben do what he truly wanted to do. They went along for 2 years, sharing a secret dream. By 1937, they'd saved a little money, bought a second-hand car. And once again, he hit the tournament trail, determined to fulfill the hopes of that little kid who had practiced hour after hour as darkness descended. But this time, he wasn't alone, and his hopes were shared by the girl at his side. When you think of big-time golf, you think of the beautiful rolling fairways, the well-kept greens and the fancy clubhouses. You think of the well-dressed crowds, the laughter in the locker room, the smiles of the winners, and the glittering championship cups. But there's another side to it. If you're an unknown out of nowhere, making your way from one tournament to another in a rickety car, staying at tourist camps, wondering if you can just win enough prize money for gasoline to keep you going. You lie awake at night going over today's mistakes. You toss fitfully as you dream of the shots you may miss tomorrow. On the course, your nerves grow tighter and tighter as a close match nears its end. Your hands grow clammy as you step up for the putt that means you're in or you're out of the money. It was tough going for Ben and Valerie as they made their way from tournament to tournament through Canada to Florida and back to California. Ben was playing good golf, but could never quite make it. He watched the champs drive up in their sporty cars with handsome luggage. Most of them were big, easygoing, carefree fellows. He heard their laughter in the locker rooms, the good-natured ribbing and the friendly praise. But he wasn't part of it, and it made him all the more determined to show what he could do. He was just 5'7", weighed 134 pounds. But what he lacked in size, he made up for in perseverance. He studied each course before he played it. Gradually, he began to hit the prize money more and more often. By 1939, he was the leading moneymaker in the game. Again in 1940, again in 1941. He wasn't flashy, but he was consistent. He finished in the money in 56 straight tournaments. But remembering the tourist camps, the cheap diners, the rattletrap car, he always played it safe. In all of those tournaments, he never won first place. He didn't play for fun or fame or glory, just to be sure of a share of the prize money. In the sports pages, they called him Little Icewater and the Mechanical Man. And even his fellow pros seemed to begrudge his success.
Ah, sure, he's a good golfer, but he'll never be a champ.
He never makes a mistake because he never takes a chance.
He's good if you want a golf machine, but I like a guy who goes for all the marbles.
But Ben Hogan just went along minding his own business. He went into the Army Air Force for 2 years and came back to take up where he left off in 1945. But it was 1948 that he reached the peak. Still playing with calm precision, he had become one of the keenest competitors in any sport. That year, he became the first man to win the Western Open, the Professional Golfers' Championship, and the United States Open. Now that he was the champ of champions, Ben Hogan didn't change. There were no celebration parties when he won. While the other pros were relaxing over a drink and swapping stories, he was still practicing or thinking golf. And there was no laughing or kidding when you played with Hogan. As he sought perfection, the crowds that followed him in admiration only annoyed him. The newspapermen who spread his fame were only a nuisance. The other pros still said things like,
"He's a great champion, but he'll never win a popularity contest."
When that guy smiles, it's a cross between friendliness and a warning that he's going to bite you. If you give him a victory dinner, his idea of a speech is to say, "Thanks for the check."
But Ben Hogan had done what he'd set out to do. Even those who found him distant and aloof admired his skill and his will to win. It was a great year for the skinny little kid from Fort Worth. Then, as he was planning for the next season, he and his wife Valerie were driving home to Texas on that foggy February morning. It was good to be going home for a rest. Then suddenly, those four glaring headlights loomed up ahead. Many a champion has been suddenly toppled from his throne. But this was different. The golf star of the year was eliminated, not just for one match, but forever, so it seemed. At first, they said it was a miracle that he lived. Then they said that he would never walk again. And it was a bad joke to wonder if he would ever play golf. He was in the hospital for nearly 2 months. And it was there that he began to realize the feeling that people everywhere had for him as the messages began to come in.
You don't know me, Ben, but I've seen you play and I'm pulling for you.
Anyone who can become a great champion you are can lick this. You can make it.
You've been in tough spots before and you always came through.
Just as he had once set out to become champion many years before, Ben Hogan went to work again. He wasn't out to show the big guys what he could do. He wasn't out to make up for the hard times he had known. He was out to repay the faith and kindness that he'd been shown by friends and strangers. He had Valerie bring his bag of golf clubs to his room. At first, he could only look at them. But he began to do exercises in bed. And when pain and fatigue were too much for him, a glance at those clubs gave him new determination. Yes, when he glanced at those clubs, he caught a glimpse of the fairways sparkling in the sun and of the bright, smooth greens. He heard the sharp crack and felt the thrill of a long, straight drive. He watched the iron shot fall true and stick on the green. And he sensed the growing tension as the match went down to the last hole, all even. At last, Ben Hogan went home in a wheelchair and then gradually began to try to walk. It was only a few painful steps at first, then a few steps more until he could go outdoors. He began to take his putter with him, and it was something sad to see this man, who had trained his nerves and body to obey his will, practicing feebly on the lawn. The next autumn he played a few practice rounds, stopping to rest again and again. Stabs of pain shot through his leg, and cold sweat touched his hands and his forehead. Then, in January 1950, almost a year after the accident, the Los Angeles Open was held at the Riviera Country Club. An announcer stood at the starting tee as one champion after another began the first round, and applause greeted each champion. And then there was a pause as he said,
"Now on the tee, Ben Hogan."
There was a moment of silence, and then a mighty roar. Everyone was amazed that Hogan had recovered, more amazed that he was playing golf again, and amazed most of all that he had entered a major tournament. Well, at first it seemed like a gallant gesture, nothing more. On his first round, he stopped from time to time to lean against a tree and pull himself together. He ended with 73, 5 strokes off the leaders. He played the second round in 69, 2 under par, went into second place. In the third round, another astonishing 69, but Sammy Snead posted a phenomenal 66, and they went into a tie. No, the crippled champion didn't score the upset of the century. Those aching legs wouldn't stand the strain, and Hogan was beaten in the playoff.
It was a great try, but what can you expect?
You've got to be in perfect shape for a championship tournament. I don't think you'll ever be the same again.
In June, they played the United States Open at the Marion Country Club at Ardmore, Pennsylvania. After the first round, he was 8 strokes behind. But by the last day, he was only 2 strokes back of Lloyd Mangrum. In the final round, he had a chance to win, but he was just too tired. He missed a 5-foot putt, a 3-foot putt, and went into a 3-way tie. That seemed like the end. But in the playoff, he took the lead again. On the 17th hole, he had a long, uphill, 50-foot putt. He lined the ball toward the cup, it curled over the green and fell in. The match was his, and Ben Hogan had come back, all the way back. In 1951, he won the Masters Championship at Augusta, Georgia. But in 1952, he lost that same Masters tournament to Sammy Snead and then finished 3rd in the U.S. Open. He was obviously tired and worn out, and it seemed that he had lost his touch. After all, he was nearing 40. He had been through a crippling accident and had gone through the cruel grind of tournament play for more than 15 years. For the next 10 months, Ben Hogan was out of competition. But when they played the Masters again just this last April, Ben Hogan was there. He was not only there, he was the Hogan of old. He started slow in the first round, then took the lead, then crushed all opposition with a 66 in the last round to set a new record of 274, five under the previous mark. But there was an even tougher test waiting in the National Open at the Oakmont Country Club near Pittsburgh only last month. Once again, this match turned into a duel with Sammy Snead. Hogan led on the first round. Snead crept closer on the second. The tension mounted. Snead went ahead by one stroke. Then Hogan came back to take the lead. On the home stretch, he went further ahead, but he was tired. Lines of fatigue twisted his face. Now and then, his injured leg twitched, and he limped slightly, no matter how he tried to hide the pain. But Hogan's mind was completely on the match at hand. Then came the 18th hole, the last hole of the match. There was a drive, then a Massey shot. I was there at Oakmont that day, and here's the moment as Hogan walked up to the ball on the green.
Now Hogan spots his ball down 6 feet away from the cup. It's a rolling green. It's uphill. It slopes to the right side. And Hogan, who has been hurrying his putts just a little bit to see them burst in his face and be a great disappointment to him, is now taking lots of time. He goes on that side of the pin, which is away from the ball. He lines it up very carefully. Now he comes back to the side on which his ball is. He does a little house cleaning between the ball and the pin. Picks up a stray blade of browned off grass. There just isn't a sound around here. The only thing you can hear in the distance is the puff of a locomotive. He lines this putt up once again. This is a very careful one for him. It could mean a birdie on this hole. It could put him one under. It could be the stroke that would give him the Open Championship. Now Ben strikes an imaginary ball off his left toe, a practice swing. He's using a brass putter. Steps up to it now. He shifts his feet. Puts the putter in the front of the ball. He's going to hit this one off his left feet. He changes his foot position twice. He's getting ready to putt. The stroke. It's in!
Yes, the cheers rang out for Ben Hogan that day. He won by five strokes and became the first American-born professional to win the National Open four times. But even before this stunning victory, Ben Hogan had remembered whispers that had been overheard from time to time.
Sure, he's a great champion on these courses. He knows them all like the back of his hand.
These American courses are just made for his style of game.
If you notice, he never takes a chance on those British courses.
If you ask me, he's afraid of them.
No, in all of his years of golf, Ben Hogan had never played in the famous British Open tournament, the tournament that many consider the greatest test in the world of golf. With the two top American titles already won, Hogan had little to gain by risking his reputation on a strange course, under adverse conditions, against many of the greatest players in the world. Nevertheless, he set sail for the historic Carnoustie course in Scotland, the course that is by legend known as the birthplace of golf. While waiting for the British Open to start, he talked with a Scots radio announcer about why he had made the journey.
Well, Ben, we know that you were the playing captain of the American Ryder Cup team in 1949, but we are still to have the thrill of seeing you in action. What I'd like to know is, what decided you to come across and compete in the British Open this year?
Well, there were several things that made me decide. Number one, I've wanted to come for some time, but it always, your dates over here always conflicted with something that I wanted to do in the States. It was some tournament over there that I wanted to play in that conflicted with this. Another thing is so many people back home wanted me to come and play over here, so I thought I'd try to satisfy. Another thing, I heard that Carnoustie is one of the finest courses in the world, and I wanted to play it.
What I'd like to know from you, Ben, is, for you, do you get any kick out of it, or is it just another big job you have in hand? How do you feel?
Well, I think it's both. I think it's a big job, and I do get a great deal of pleasure out of it. Golf is my life, Competition is my life. If it wasn't for competition, I doubt if I'd be in it. Sure, I work hard, and that's the enjoyment I get out of it, competing, not necessarily winning. Sure, we get a great bang out of winning, and certainly not losing, but nevertheless, it's a game. It's my life. I thoroughly enjoy it, and all in all, I think it's just a wonderful game. I can highly recommend it to anyone.
Ben Hogan said that golf was his life, and when he went out on that famed Carnoustie course, he played as if his life depended on it. This was the greatest challenge he had ever faced, the climax of the career that began when he was a skinny kid first playing golf as a caddy back in Fort Worth in Texas. The odds are always tremendously against any given player in one tournament, but if Ben Hogan lost, it would cast a shadow across all of his bright victories. That was the chance Ben Hogan took. The crowds of Scotsmen cheered him, but there's always an undercurrent of hope that the mighty may topple. And on the hard, windswept course at Carnoustie, it seemed as if just that might happen. The roughly kept, rugged course was far different than anything he was used to. With an injured leg and shoulder that ached with the cold and damp, he had to play through wind and hail and rain. After the first round, he was 2 strokes behind. On the second round, even fate seemed against him. 6 putts rimmed the cup and failed to drop, and he was still 2 strokes behind. On the first round of the final day of play, he pulled up even. Then, on the last 18 holes, he shot one of the most remarkable rounds of his amazing career. Without faltering on a single shot, he won by 4 full strokes. After the match was over, the BBC announcer asked Cecil Binns, Hogan's caddy, a question.
Now, Cecil, what is your opinion now? You've caddied for Ben Hogan today, and what do you think of him as a golfer?
I think he's the finest golfer that I've ever caddied for.
And when you were here in practice with him, did you help him at all? Did he ask your advice frequently?
Well, today he asked me quite a number of shots, especially during the last round.
Now, you've carried for a lot of great players, a lot of great golfers, and you would say quite definitely that Ben is the greatest player that you have carried for. And you like carrying for him?
Yes, I mean, he's a wonderful man to work for. He's very, very fair. Uh-huh. He's stern, but he never says anything nasty to you. He's sort of considerate, and when you practice, he asks you to do your job, and you do it, and there's no complaints at all.
No complaints. Well, there it is then. Cecil Dims, who's caddied for some of the greatest golfers in the world, although he's quite a young man. He's not an old man. He's caddied for, in post-war years, some of the greatest golfers in the world, and his opinion is that Ben Hogan is the greatest of them all. And thank you very much, Cecil, for coming along.
And thank you, sir.
He may well be the best that anyone ever caddied for, this champion who was once a caddy himself. When he won the greatest match of his career, Ben Hogan's wife, Valerie, was at his side, as she had been in all of his victories and defeats. As she stood there, watching Ben receive the winner's trophy, someone asked if this was the happiest moment of her life. She thought a moment and said, "No. The happiest moment was when Ben first won again after the crash." That's our tribute to Ben Hogan. Be with us next week when the All-American Sports Show salutes the heavyweight champion of the world, Rocky Marciano.
This has been an NBC Radio Network production. The second in a series of All-American Sports Shows with Joe Hassel. Music by Cliff Cameron. Our program was written by Jack C. Wilson and produced and directed by Dan Sutter. Weekdays, hear the phrase that pays on NBC.